Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned. What you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody. So after our week off from the Top 100 Project with the Not 100 Project, now we're back to our normal routine. So let's get into last week's Coming Attractions trivia. Name at least two of the films directed by the Joel McRae character John L. Sullivan in this week's podcast movie, Sullivan's Travels.
Tick, tock, tick, tock. I don't know. I never bothered looking it up. I'm going to give you the pleasure of saying.
They mentioned three of them in all their little punny type titles. Ants in Your Plants of 1939, Hey Hey in the Hayloft, and So Long Sarong.
I don't know why he would be ashamed of those movies.
They're not too far away from being porno titles. Alright, so Sullivan's Travels is the 29th movie in the Top 100 Project. It was not on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, but got the 2007 votes to finish in 61st place between Duck Soup and American Graffiti. Sullivan's Travels came out in December 1941. Now that would have been right around the time of Pearl Harbor, and then got wide release by Paramount on January 28th, 1942. We continue with a recurring theme in the 1940s. Sullivan's Travels was not a big hit with audiences. Its reviews were mixed too. Beverly will read our skinny.
Hollywood director of silly comedies John L. Sullivan, played by Joel McRae, seeks to make a more meaningful film about poverty and suffering. His tragic comic quest to understand the have-nots yields a new friend called The Girl, played by Veronica Lake, and finds them getting into various hijinks. Sullivan ends up in jail, and all seems lost because his friends and co-workers think he's dead.
Hilarious!
Hilarious!
It is a comedy. Well, here's the movie in a nutshell. Lightweight tries to be heavyweight, but ends up being deadweight. Wait! He's happy being lightweight.
That was a good one.
I wrote that one in the middle of the night. Okay, well, Sullivan's Travels, this is not going to be pretty. But the floor is yours, lady.
So Ryan already knows how I feel about this movie because I started getting outraged as we were watching it. I think my eye rolling became so aggressive that it was probably audible. And I'll say this first, it's not a terrible movie the way, say, I criticize Swing Time for being just so god-awful at parts. But it's really, before I say any other criticism, it's really not good enough to be on this list, period. If you take away all my other complaints, which in my opinion are valid, just as a movie, as the script, the performances, the tone was really inconsistent. It went between tragedy and comedy. To me, just not smoothly enough. It just didn't pull it off. The performances were good. They just weren't great. If we are going to talk about the best thing about this movie is probably the physical comedy, but which was enjoyable, but once you measure it up against the actual masters of physical comedy that we've already seen, like Chaplin and Keaton and the Marx Brothers, forget it. Like, they don't even hold a candle to it. It's cute, but that's really, really not good enough. But my real criticism is just the message of the film, which is anything but ambiguous. Throughout the movie, Sullivan is repeatedly trying to relate to the poor, but what the movie keeps telling you over and over again is just how much he doesn't belong there, as though he has some kind of specialness. He keeps accidentally winding up in Hollywood until he gets arrested and thrown in prison, and they think he's dead through some elaborate circumstances. And this, even though he's been arrested and tried and convicted for attacking somebody with a rock, and it wasn't a mistake, he attacked a person with a rock, and then he went to prison. And then he finally devised a plan to make everybody know who he was, which is, wait, you can't send me to prison. I'm rich. You can't send a rich white man to prison. You can't do that. And it turns out they can't. And the movie never had any problem with this. They didn't even bother explaining how the mechanisms work that he should have been released from prison. It's literally as though once people realize that he was who he said he was, which was a rich white man, they just let him out of prison, and that was that. There's lots more to it And just the way that they treat poverty throughout the film, and the message, of course, is that, you know, he wants to do something good for the poor, and he thinks that what he has to do is make a serious movie. And I'm sure he was referring to something like Grapes of Wrath, or something like How Green Was My Ballet, which is the movie that won the Oscar that year. Serious films about the poor, the suffering, the downtrodden, and he wanted to do something good for society. Like, he had these great intentions, but what he discovers once he's actually finally forced to be poor and not be able to just, like, call his butler when things got bad or go and steal his own car, which he does, because he can't even last one single day the first time he goes out to be poor without, you know, impressing a cute girl with his car. But yeah, once he finally is forced to be poor, he discovers that the best thing he can do for the downtrodden people is to make them laugh and just delight them with the silly comedies that he was already making, and that there's an actual value to the work he was doing. I agree with that sentiment.
You don't agree with the way it was done?
Well, the way it was done was to illustrate that somehow he actually is more important than the poor people that he's entertaining.
I don't think he thinks that.
Well, then why is he so insistent that once people learn who he is and that he's actually rich, that he'll get out of prison? He knows that he's different from them, and he knows once the authorities learn that he is wealthy, that he works in Hollywood.
When I read the reviews of this film online about how this is a satire, I think I'd mentioned that to you when it was over, and you didn't buy that it's a satire. Preston Sturges, who wrote and directed and produced, was a smart guy, and I think you could argue that this film was intending Sullivan not to be a nitwit, but to be a oblivious leftist who's trying to do the right thing, who really honestly wants to make a meaningful movie.
And I agree with that. I don't think he's a bad guy.
And he does care about these kinds of people that he cannot relate to. And he probably knows right from the start, I can't relate to these. Well, that's, I guess, the point. I can't relate to them, so let me try to relate to them.
Yeah, and actually, like I said, his intentions as a character are actually really good. And he does want to do good, and that's why he goes out on this mission in the first place. But it's not necessarily his character that is illustrating these points. I mean, just in the script itself, it's supposed to be so much about the poverty experience, or that's what he's supposed to care about, yet not one single poor person has a line in the movie until almost the last half hour.
And that's a guy who's in jail.
And that's one of his prison mates whose name is Trusty. Like, that's how he's credited. and all he does is help him, and he's incredibly generous and kind, as are actually a lot of other poor people in the movie. But he's the only one that has a voice at all, and his voice is basically only spent to help Sullivan. And then once Sullivan is released from prison, you know, we're just meant to assume that Trusty, because he's not rich, because he doesn't have powerful friends, is left to rot in this
to find a new friend.
Yeah, to find a new friend to help out. And
in the prison camp.
Yeah, they treat the poor with a certain level of nobility, but there's also this underlying theme that the privileged deserve their privilege. And
no, but hold on. You don't think that that's potentially a satire and a very deliberate move by a canny writer and director to say that Sullivan, while not being a bad person, and while he is trying to get it, doesn't get it and never will get it. And that at the end, the whole message
I don't think that forgives the fact that this incredible injustice happens, and it's never addressed by the film or by Sullivan or by anybody.
But the movie's trying to be a comedy. It's about something that really means something, which is a noble thing for the film to try to do. This sort of meta thing where the film and the film that he wants to make are both meaningful. But then the whole point as well is, let's have these hijinks, let's have this long chase scene, which is not all that funny, really, where everyone's falling around in the camper, and the poor black cook is getting covered in his own food, and I don't know what they're supposed to be doing on that road, that it's that bad, in that bad a shape, that they're being literally tossed around. But it's supposed to be funny, and I don't know
that
it really is.
It was cute, but it wasn't amazing.
But I'm just saying that it's entirely possible that this movie is supposed to be as satirical as something like Network. Although you always hear Sidney Lumet say, that movie was sheer reportage. Well, no, it's a satire. It's same idea with this.
I see what you're saying, and I agree that the elements you're talking about, like Sullivan is a character, it is satirical, and Preston Sturges is poking fun at himself. But I feel like as they were making this satire, they didn't really get it. Like, you know, they say privilege is most invisible to those who experience privilege. Well, it seems like they're missing the point.
But isn't it possible that the filmmaker gets that, and he's mocking that, And that's why Sullivan at the end gets away with everything and realizes, I will make comedies after all. They mean something to people, which is also true.
I guess that's possible. If it's that sophisticated, it went over my head.
If the movie had been funnier, because it isn't nearly as funny as The Lady Eve. That's the one that if you're going to pick a Sturgis movie of these two or any movies that he made, I think Lady Eve is easier, the better movie, and should have. And it was the same year as this, in fact. Mm-hmm. Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck. And you mentioned physical comedy. I mean, Fonda does stuff in that movie that we've seen people do that you might, on some sitcom, you roll your eyes and think, well, that was just stupid. But when he falls over the couch in that movie,
it's really funny. That was really funny.
There aren't really, I don't know, even two moments in Sullivan's Travels that are as funny as some of the funniest moments in The Lady Eve, which was also about wealthy people and kind of the obliviousness of them. And also a good-hearted person, the Henry Fonda character and the Joel McRae character.
And I get that he's poking fun. Really, the part that bothered me more than anything, you know, the film purports to have sympathy with the poor, but it's told entirely from the perspective of a wealthy man who, in the end, has his worldview completely reinforced so that he can go on and enjoy being a rich film director without feeling guilty. There's this kind of underlying suggestion that the wealthy are born with privilege that they deserve and that they would have no matter what circumstances they were born into.
And the poor could never be.
And the poor never could have those privileges. But the part that really crosses the line for me is that justice is never served, that he commits this crime, which is actually pretty bad. You know, he is angry. He viciously beats a man with a rock. Yeah, that guy was a jerk, but he viciously beats a man with a rock. If somebody viciously beat me with a rock, I would like to think, no matter how wealthy he was, he would be punished for that crime.
Except I think that it's important to remember that he's not in his right mind. He doesn't remember who he is when that happens.
So, but then show me that, like, just the briefest scene where he has a retrial where they claim temporary insanity or, like, head trauma or whatever argument they made. Just show me that something happened other than people discovering his true identity to get him out of that work camp where we leave Trusty behind, who, presumably, his crime was no worse than Sullivan's.
I think it's a very reasonable point, but you could argue that if this movie was trying to be satirical the whole way and you're saying that, that it maybe didn't work or you didn't get the satire, that maybe if they had done a scene like that, it would have been him talking to the judge and, I'm a rich Hollywood director. Okay, you're out of here. All you need to say was rare. Yeah.
But that would be satire, right? But they don't have a scene like that. And I know I keep going over and over that particular detail, but I think that it's kind of the best example of what's happens in subtler ways throughout the film, that kind of attitude. You know, and critics love this film, but partly because it reinforces their worldview. No, some of them did, though. They certainly
They were very
now.
Split.
Yeah. Even if the critics were split then, I mean, obviously the critics have universally agreed that this is a great film, which kind of mystifies me on not just my personal problem with the treatment of privilege, but also it's just not a good enough movie. I mean, all the critics that I saw were pretty positive. It had a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's highly ranked on the IMDb as well.
I'm surprised people like this movie as much as they did. It just isn't good enough to make up for its shortcomings.
It's also the DVD that we own is Criterion. I remember when I bought it, it was, I think, $65.
You're a bigger Preston Sturges fan than I am. I like The Lady Eve, but I don't think I ever loved it as much as you did.
The rest of his filmography, though, I didn't love it. I have seen a few of them twice, and to be honest, I don't really remember that much about some of them. Those two, Sullivan's Travels, Lady Eve, I've seen by far the most. They were his third and fourth movies. He made several others through the 40s, and then he was pretty much done. But I think he hit his high point almost right away. Okay, let's get away from the politics then, and let's start talking about the actual what's in the movie, and what's supposed to be in the movie, and what we're, I think, supposed to get out of it. I thought it was interesting that it's kind of similar to It Happened One Night, because you got the traveling while broke with a woman you love theme that's in that movie.
Yeah, and the privileged person who suddenly finds themselves broke.
Yeah,
and has to, know, is motivated to not call for help, even though they could.
And yet that movie, as we talked about during that podcast, for a movie that was made during the production code era that could never have shown sex and was never going to take things too far that way, especially since she's engaged and they're not married and all those kinds of things you couldn't show back then, the movie is very sexy. This movie is strange in that way because Veronica Lake and Joel McRae don't seem to have any kind of sexual chemistry. It's like a completely desexualized.
It's almost like a platonic or brother-sister relationship.
And he's 6'3", she's 4'11". Now, they were cast partly for that reason, to play off that comic notion of, what is that, a foot and a half difference?
Yeah.
But she does look like a little sister or his daughter or something a lot of the time.
She's supposed to be passing for a little boy at some point. And just another small criticism If you're Veronica Lake, first of all, you can never pass for a boy, because she's a beautiful woman who always is going to look like a woman. But if you're going to try and pass for a boy, don't wear lipstick. Just saying.
Not very many boys in the 40s wore lipstick.
Yeah, well, maybe they did, hey.
Especially bums.
That's not accurate. I just lipstick was rationed in the war. Boys weren't wearing it. Of course it was.
And yet, ironically, the flick is obsessed with sex. Those titles I talked about at the beginning of the film. So Long, Sarong.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Hey, and the Hayloft.
Oh, yeah, you're right. They're all sex comedies.
And then Ants in Your Plants is supposed to be a play on Ants in Your Pants.
Yeah.
That one's not quite so overt. And then there's the Lake has got her phallic hairbrush after the pool scene, the way she's stroking it. So the movie's got this sort of mini obsession with it and also no real knowledge of it. That's real ability to play it with any sort of heat between the two of them.
That's because of the code. They actually were under restrictions of how their relationship could play out while they were on their bums off.
Well, yes, and he is married as well. He's married to somebody he doesn't love, but he is married. Well, yeah, but we've seen other movies that have gotten around some of the things through the production code, AFI movies and otherwise.
And then eventually they're out of nowhere, almost a couple. They did not have a ton of chemistry, the two of them. They were cute, actually, as friends, like in a friendly way. They worked, but when the time came to turn it into a romance, it felt... And the story with his convenient wife is so dumb that it's insulting. Like, it doesn't even make sense why anybody would agree to this circumstance where he marries this woman who he doesn't love strictly for convenience of paying less tax.
And pays more money to
have her as a wife. Yeah, and then she cons him into paying her whatever, I don't know, what you would call it, an allowance or alimony or something, so that it actually costs him more money and she won't grant him a divorce.
That's not a potential satire thing, too? Somebody who's rich and famous in Hollywood who marries somebody casually, which they've all done, not all, so many of them have done so often, and then kind of pay for it.
Not to save money on taxes.
Well, that's just a made-up silly reason that Sturges came up with.
That's like, what do you call it when like these romantic comedies always have these fake barriers that getting in between the couple?
The idiot plot.
The idiot plot. Yeah, it's a bit of an idiot plot.
Right, and speaking of Lake and McRae, they didn't get along very well during the production.
That's right.
And McRae turned down a future project to avoid having to work with her again.
Wow.
I don't know whose fault that was, but I read that someone else didn't like working with her either, some other big name, so...
Yeah, from my research, she does not have a great reputation.
Hmm. She was only 20 during the production, and she was also pregnant.
Yeah, she didn't tell anyone,
and Sturges was angry with her.
Yeah.
This wasn't her debut, but it was the one that put her on the map. Now, McRae, on the other hand, had been acting since the beginning of the sound era. Jazz singer callback, and had already worked with Hitchcock, DeMille, Hawks, and Wyler, some big names, and he later became known primarily as a star of Westerns.
I'd never heard of him before we saw this.
This is the only time we're going to see him or Lake on the project, so don't get too comfortable with them because they're going to be gone. They are the only two major players in the movie. We see a lot of other people pretty regularly. William Demarest, who's in, I think, every Sturges movie, 10, I guess it was, that rather written and directed by Sturges. And he was pretty funny in The Lady Eve as Muggsy. But I really don't know that we need to mention any other actors in the movie. And Sturges used a ton of people from his stock company. Most directors at that time did have a stock company. He really had one.
But there weren't really any other major characters, true.
The butler and some of the... I actually really liked the scene in the early part of the film with the two executives.
Yeah, that was actually pretty...
That's my favorite scene in the whole film. It's the second scene.
The stuff
scene.
That takes place, in the production office is actually really cute.
Those two actors
are... They have great rat-a-tat.
Yeah, they work well with McRae. And it's also a long, unbroken take. It goes on forever.
Oh, I didn't
know. I think the entire scene of them in that office discussing what him wanting to make, and here we say it for the first time, "Oh, brother, where art thou?"
Oh, yeah, we totally have to
Which
talk
most
that.
Modern people who know anything about the Coens would know that movie. Yeah. One of their most popular films. George Clooney, of course, is in that. And there's a movie that's the Coens have said is a bit of a play off the idea of what would have come next.
Yeah, because the script Sullivan wants to make is called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's a fictional movie, but yeah, they said that after he went on his journey and discovered the value of comedy, but felt like he had this kinship with the tramps, that's the movie he would have made. That he would have made Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, but he would have made it funny.
And the fitting situation here is the Coens almost always have made comedies of their own, and most of them pretty lightweight, unimportant type movies. And it's funny how now they're always rewarded with Oscar nominations and all the award nominations from various bodies when they never really were before, except for Fargo.
Yeah. Well, when we were talking about how the tone is inconsistent in Sullivan's Travels, and I was like, it's really hard to make a comedy that can also have serious scenes and serious themes. And I was like, God, the only directors I can think of who pull it off are the Coen brothers.
Fargo is a classic example.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh, yeah, and the whole Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Like, you know, like, it is totally possible that I just missed the point on some level of this movie. And since I have done a lot of criticizing and, like, dumping on it, I will talk about one detail and scene that I really, really liked, and that was near the end when he's in the prison camp. He discovers the value of comedy because they have a movie night and all the prisoners are really excited about the movie night. Yeah, and it takes place in a church, and it's a black church full of African-Americans with the African-American preacher, and he welcomes the prisoners.
They're true Christians.
They're true Christians, and they welcome the prisoners to come watch a movie in the church with them.
Put them out of the front two rows, in fact. They move out of the front two rows.
Yeah, yeah, and apparently at the time, it was commended for being one of the very few examples of African-Americans being portrayed in film where they weren't, you know, the butt of a joke, kind of like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the porters, or these...
Or, well, the cook earlier in this movie and...
Yeah, actually, that's an even better
in
example.
In the runaway bus scene.
Yeah, they're buffoons or they're,
but
like,
then everybody
mammies.
In that bus is kind of ridiculous, so it's not just him.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, in that scene, which is a really sweet scene, I actually really like that one a lot, too.
Yeah, that that's moment really actually was really... I was very, very happy to see that he had that detail, and actually, that does play to the true desire to make people think twice about their preconceived notions of the poor or the black communities or whatever, like the stuff that they're addressing in this movie. So I do give it credit for that.
Well, while that scene also is sweet and touching and meaningful, the short they show, the Pluto hijinks they show in the movie, which was supposed to have been a Chaplin short.
Oh, really?
But Charlie Chaplin didn't let him have the rights and let Sturges just show one of his shorts. But the Pluto thing is not really all that funny. I think I've actually watched that online. But the way they react to it, I remember,
know, it's a little over
the first
top.
Few times I saw the movie, I remember laughing at that almost as loud as they were because their reaction is so great. Them enjoying it so much, the prisoners and the various members of the church enjoying it as much as they do, was enjoyable for me. And when McRae finally looks around and realizes, well, why don't I enjoy this too? Just because I'm having this horrible experience. Hey, that is pretty great. So I find not only is it touching, but it is infectiously funny.
Yeah, the escapism of it. Thought it was a little overkill.
Okay, now
people are like hurting themselves laughing. It's I get it. It felt
that's
like
the
it
escape,
just,
I guess.
I guess, but they drove the point home.
Yeah, you know? Well, they did. That's definitely true. We talked a lot about the Coens a minute ago. The other major filmmaker that I want to talk about is Mr. Spielberg. And I read somewhere, I don't know if this is true, but I read this years ago, that on the original list, Sullivan's Travels didn't make it. Spielberg had 5 films, and he apparently said he would have been happy to see one of his films knocked off to make room for Sullivan's Travels. Well, Sullivan's Travels made it the second time, of course, and Spielberg still had 5 films because he lost one and gained another. So he obviously felt the same way about this film. And even though he's been a guy who's made so many popcorn films, he's also made so many incredibly serious movies.
That's true.
Munich and Schindler's List and Lincoln and a long list, Saving Private Ryan, of course, although some of those were also massive hits. But he still does come back to his popcorn films, like the 4th Indiana Jones film.
Well, the film, in a way, is like almost directly speaking to him.
Maybe so, yeah.
Like, hey, I know people criticize you because you made an inhuman amount of money just making, like, silly movies that entertain people. But guess what? You're doing more for society. Like, you're actually a benefit to society. Like, and these are the type of people that would be voting on which films have value. It's a lot of them are filmmakers, so it really reinforces their values. Like, if I was a writer and I entered a writing contest that I knew was going to be judged by, like, phys ed teachers, I would probably write a story about phys ed teachers that reaffirms that phys ed teachers are important in society and that they deserve all the privileges that they got. So it's not that surprising that critics and filmmakers and that type of people would love this movie. It's kind of like when Hugo got all that great attention from critics and other, you know, Hollywood just loved that movie. Well, of course they did. That movie just lays it on so thick that movies of dreams come to life.
Yeah, and the movie wasn't very successful with audiences, though. It was not a big hit.
It really wasn't. It was, especially for a Scorsese movie.
He made it for his kid. I think he said as much on The Daily Show.
And he's trying to say to his kid, look, my career had a lot of value.
I killed a lot of people on screen.
Filmmaker Characters are very important. Movies are the most important thing.
Well, you just mentioned Hugo, a movie that came out the year after it, a year ago, was Argo, which mm-hmm. I saw recently and read the reviews of recently. And that movie, I think one of their critics said something like, hooray for Hollywood was their tagline for the movie.
Yeah.
Which is also what Sullivan's Travels and Hugo could be accused of
Hollywood
doing.
Actually plays like a
We're saving the world!
I know. Hollywood plays such a super small role in actually saving those hostages, but they're played up so big in the movie. Like, and of course, again, Hollywood's like, look what we did. I like this movie.
It was actually Canada.
It was Canada, you guys. Look, Canada played their part. Hollywood played their part. I would say maybe the CIA played a bigger part. I'm just saying. They maybe should take most of the credit.
But still, hooray for Hollywood.
But hooray for Hollywood.
With a little sex. And continuing on the theme of Hollywood films, I want to get back to something you said earlier. You stole a point of mine, and I'm glad you did. And that would be The Grapes of Wrath.
Mm.
Because at one point when he's on Skid Row, I had expected him to run into the Joads.
Mm-hmm. Only they wouldn't have any speaking part. They wouldn't have any lines. They would just be background players.
Another homage to Hollywood is that the movie constantly mentions Lubitsch, Ernst Lubitsch.
Oh, I never caught on.
Yeah, he's a filmmaker from the 30s, and I think he was still working into the 40s. Yes, he was into the 40s. And he made, again, light comedies, romantic comedies. I don't know if he made anything of consequence. But maybe that's another thing where the movie's saying, yeah, look at Lubitsch, he's doing it. He's making movies that don't mean anything, but people enjoy them. When I've been drinking late at night and I want to watch some movie that I've seen before and just have a good time, it's never going to be some hard Grapes of Wrath type film. It's going to be Galaxy Quest. It's going to be I Love You, Man, which I've seen so many times in that situation.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be a fun, funny movie.
I wonder if when, you know, for some reason comedies especially have to be like over 40 or 50 years old before we can acknowledge that they were great films. And I wonder if which of the popular comedies now will be the ones that people remember years from now.
We've agreed on this. If we were to do, after this project is done in a few years, the other AFI list and carry this on until we're old people, if we ever did the comedy list, I don't think we will. That's probably the one I like the least of all the lists.
Yeah.
Because there's so many movies, as you just said, that are ancient that aren't really all that funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't acknowledge the more recent ones. And now the comedy list came out around the time of some of the movies I've mentioned that I think are great comedies. And some of the Coen ones were either not nominated or couldn't have been. They weren't out yet or they had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
I think 99 is a good year for comedy. Galaxy Quest and Bowfinger are two of my favorites. Some of the stuff Kevin Smith was doing around that time was he was at his peak.
Like Being John Malkovich came out in 99.
Right,
too.
Exactly. And the comedy list I think was the year after, so they couldn't have even been nominated. But if there was any fairness in this sort of thing, it would be at least 10 or 15 from the late 90s and even early 2000s.
It's funny because in one way, comedy doesn't age well, but on the other way, it has to be over 50 years old before critics will acknowledge that it's anything more than silly popcorn fare.
And as you and I have agreed, very few of the movies we've now seen on the list really make us laugh a lot from the old days.
I think the movie that made me laugh the hardest was probably Modern Times or Gold Rush. Other than that, you know, you get a chuckle and you're certainly amused, but it's not like when I watch, you know, Talladega Nights and I'm cracking up. Or Tropic Thunder, that's a great one.
Another movie about movies.
Yeah, yeah.
That mocks Hollywood mercilessly.
Yeah,
but very
that's
funnily.
True, actually.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Preston Sturges before we wrap. This was his only AFI-er, and he was a triple threat when he did this movie. He was a producer, director, and writer. Like John Huston had become, I don't know if Huston was a producer actually, but Huston was a writer and director this same year at The Maltese Falcon. He, like Huston, had gone from being a well-regarded writer to a superstar writer-director very quickly once he actually got the chance, but both of them had toiled for about 10 years writing mm-hmm. screenplays and being someone else's second banana. And what Sturges did that maybe Huston didn't do so much, but Ford was certainly known for doing this, was he used the same actors over mm-hmm. and over again in that stock company. Let's just recast people in different roles, except for his stars. Most of them did not repeat over and over again.
The Coens do that as well.
Right, yeah.
They use the same actors over and over.
Yeah. It wasn't really a technically accomplished picture the way that Citizen Kane was that same year, even Maltese Falcon, mm-hmm. the last two top 100s we've done. But it was fairly well done, I thought. And the one thing I would criticize is the reverse of what people usually criticize about old films. And that is that it was black and white, as all the films in the top 100 in the 40s from Fantasia on are, which is black and white. I actually think this might have been a better movie in color. Because you could have had the eye-popping Technicolor scenes when he's still in Hollywood, and even the early part of when he's on his odyssey and not able to get anywhere. As you said, he keeps ending up back at home. And then maybe you desaturate the colors when he starts going through the stuff on the Poverty Row type stuff. Not make it black and white, literally, but have the set decoration and the makeup and everything else be so grayish that you have that contrast. I thought that was something that could have worked well. Not that it's a problem with black and white, but it's one of those movies I think might have been better.
And then Veronica Lake's lipstick could have really popped.
Yeah, when she's supposed to be a boy and yeah. She would have fooled no one. I want to say one more thing about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the non-movie, not the actual Coen Brother movie. I kind of want to see it. I want to see if Sullivan has any talent at all for making a prestige picture.
I'm so curious of what the plot of that movie would have been and how it would have, what it would have been about.
I think it would have been rather terrible.
Maybe.
He just wasn't cut out for it. Maybe he knew that. Maybe at the end of the whole cockeyed caravan line is about how, for me to survive in this cockeyed caravan, I better stick with what I know.
I know. He was probably like, now that I've actually experienced poverty, I will do whatever it takes to keep my mansion.
And there's a part of me that knows that I'm out of my wheelhouse if I try to do something meaningful.
Yeah.
Let's stick to Ants and Your Plants of 1949, 1973, as far as I can go.
Ants and Your Plants, too.
Plantsier. Okay, so the very brief list of awards and other AFI lists. Another film on the National Film Registry in 1990, the second year they did that. And two other AFI lists were pretty highly ranked. 33rd on Top 100 Laughs and 25th on Top 100 Cheers. I don't think you're going to agree with either one of those. Oh,
especially Cheers.
But the Cockeyed Caravan.
Oh,
another thing I'll say about the awards and lists is that an actual award makes a cameo. The Oscar that Sturges won for writing The Great McGinty makes a cameo at the end of the film.
Yeah, in his production office. It's on the shelf, right? You pointed that out. That was pretty neat. It's a pretty neat little detail, actually.
Yeah.
So before we wrap it up, just my final thought. I know I've kind of dumped all over it. Not that it's not worth watching, actually. It still had its charm. Veronica Lake is absolutely charismatic and beautiful. And I almost like want people to watch it because I would love to hear other people's opinion on what I said. Like, do other people see what I see, or am I just being like a boneheaded, hair trigger liberal?
It's almost like the Swing Time podcast where you spent, 25 minutes ripping into that one. It'd be the same thing. Let people watch this musical and see that they have a problem with it too, or the racism that may not be very well acknowledged in Gone with the Wind and some other movies.
Yeah, the sexism in Philadelphia Story, which I still recommend it as a movie. You kind of have to point out these things.
Because if people were to see Citizen Kane for either the first time or maybe for the first time in a while, they're not likely to say we're wrong about talking about how it's a great movie, or maybe The Maltese Falcon, or when we get to Casablanca soon, and on.
But I was genuinely surprised when I looked at the reviews and I didn't see anybody else kind of point out what I saw, which was the injustice of the ending.
So yeah, I'd be curious to see if our listeners have noticed that same kind of thing with this movie and with other ones.
Yeah, I kind of want to hear what people think about
that.
Do they
think that about those issues we're dead wrong? All right, up next on the Top 100 Project is James Cagney's only AFI-er, Yankee Doodle Dandy, a musical again. We haven't done one for a little while. And so the coming attractions trivia for Yankee Doodle Dandy is this. Which Yankee Doodle Dandy actor was also in two other AFI films during the 1940s? So three total for that one guy.
All right. In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, or you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And please feel free to email me all of your disagreements of my opinion at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
With a little sex in it.
And cut.